Welcome back to the History of South Africa podcast with me, your host, Des Latham. This is episode 192, and what a packed episode it is. The Sand River Convention, and then after this episode, we'll continue to the Battle of the Berea. The former created a new state called the Zuid-Afrikaanse Republiek, and the latter reinforced the Basutu power under Moshoeshoe, which would ultimately lead to the Kingdom of Lesotho being born. Two events that took place at the bookends of 1852, the convention signed in January and the Battle of Berea in December, both left their indelible marks on South African history. The decision by the British government to sign a convention with the Boers of the Transvaal was the result of two local officials, William Samuel Hogg and Charles Mostyne Owen. Because the Eighth Frontier War against Amakhosa was going so badly, it was imperative for the British to deal with other possible threats. When they reached Bloemfontein in November 1851, Hogg and Owen were assailed by conspiracy, tales of intrigue, some of which I explained last episode. Hogg was the senior of the two and realized pretty quickly that the biggest problem was the annexation of the Orange River sovereignty by Sir Harry Smith. The governor, said Hogg in a letter, was either deceived or deceived himself in supposing that the majority of the white people here ever desired British authority to be extended over them. That was the last thing the Boers wanted. He also realized that the other challenge to any authority in the Orange River sovereignty was the chaos between different groups of people and the involvement of various British officials in these conflicts. You know about that as well. But Hogg described as the incessant interference in the incessant quarrels of the native tribes. It was time to make a deal and get the hell out of the Transvaal region. Hogg and Owen were very much men of their time. They believed that the Europeans should sign a document, and in so doing excluded the other forms of power on the veld, in particular King Moshoeshoe of the Basutu. By ignoring the king, these two technocrats created the scenario which would lead to the Battle of Berea in December. But first things first. The reason for concentrating on the Sand River Convention, folks, is that two major wars would be fought over tenets and the terms of this convention, both the First Boer War of 1879 and the Second Boer War of 1899 were directly linked to this convention. In short, the British were going to dishonour the terms, I'm sure that shocks you, which would infuriate the Boers, which would motivate thousands of burghers to take up arms against the empire throughout the coming half century and beyond. The cardinal dates in the history of the Boers in South Africa of this period are 1849 and 1852, at least according to historians like Manfred Nathan. In 1849, the Trekkers resolved to become one people with a settled home across the Vaal, closing the main era of Voortrekker wanderings, and in 1852, when the principal external power called Great Britain recognized their separate and independent existence. Two more dates of significance are coming up. 1858, that's when the Constitution of the Republic came into being, and 1860, when Boer unity was finally achieved. Let's not get ahead of ourselves. We're dealing with 1852 and January. For the Voortrekkers, there were two centers of power at this point, one around Andries Pretorius and the other around Hendrik Potgieter. The main cause of conflict was Potgieter's belief that his position of Commandant-General of the Voortrekkers was a post for life. Pretorius and his adherents feared the concentration of military power in one man's hand, and Potgieter's adherents believed Pretorius had an insatiable power lust. Each of these two believed they were entitled to be numero uno, nummer een, die generaal, and each believed the other was court brook, not substantial enough to equal themselves. Putting this another way, these two megalomaniacs of the Trekkers had been fighting for so long they had poisoned any possibility of reconciliation between their two peoples. Should either pass away, the situation would have changed, but these men weren't going to go anywhere quietly, at least for a while. Still, in March 1849, A gathering of the Boers in Urgstadt saw delegates from both sides meet along with those from other districts, and preliminary resolutions favouring a united Trekker government were taken. A follow-up meeting in Daardepoort in the Magaliesberg on May 23, 1849, led to more resolutions, the main being that the white inhabitants of the Transvaal should unite and that their affairs be administered by a single government. They also agreed that the Volksraad should be the supreme authority. The new name of this territory was the United Confederation of the Whole Community on this side of the Vaal River. I kid you not, that was the title. So clumsy, it raised a few chuckles down south in the Cape. However, this was the precursor to the Zuid-Afrikaanse Republiek, the South African Republic, the ZAR. Just to segue for a moment, South Africa's country code, as we know, is ZA. The issuing of codes to countries began with the 1909 and then the 1924 Paris Conventions for International Vehicle Registration Marks. But South Africa was not initially part of these, and the code SA was allocated to the Saarland, which was a French protectorate carved out of Germany after World War I. South Africa signed up to the Paris Conventions in 1936, so theoretically it could have been allocated the code SA, since the Saarland had been returned to Germany, and at the time there was still a transformation from Dutch to Afrikaans. Dutch was still an official language of South Africa, and therefore it made sense to use the code ZA. The international standard ISO 31661 was established in 1974 and assigned a two-letter code for each country, and ZA was kept for South Africa to avoid a clash with Saudi Arabia. Then the top-level country domains for the internet were based on ISO 31661, so South Africa ended up as .za. So in a way, the Sunt River Convention of 1852 and the creation of Die Zuid-Afrikaanse Republiek are directly linked to our internet code of .co.za. Shuffling back to our story, the United Confederation of the Whole Community on this side of the Vaal River, takes quite a breath to read that line, was comprised of 21 members, 6 from Urgstadt, 14 from the other districts. Pretorius was the chairman, which meant that Potgieter held his nose and backed away, although he didn't formally oppose the union. This gathering ratified the 33 articles you've heard about previously, passed at Potchefstroom in 1844. Another meeting was held at Daardepoort and then Kruisbos in September 1849, and that secured its future. One problem, well, quite a few actually. No one knew what powers the Volksraad wielded. These were undefined. And then what time should the Volksraad gather? No one knew. And where would they be meeting? No one knew. So what happened was that they would meet erratically and under the leadership of the Commandant General, who was actually Potgieter, not under the leadership of Pretorius. But Pretorius's followers did not respect Potgieter's authority. Good grief. And they say we have chaos in South African politics in the 21st century? Squabbles followed, unseemly squabble. Toys were thrown out of cots, handbags at 6 paces, slaps dispensed, growling through beards at braai places, heads turned in disgust, the whole shebang. By January 1851, the Volksraad did what any normal group of parliamentarians would do when two males strut about, ignoring each other, and assign 4 commandant-generals equal in rank and independent of each other, watering down Potgieter and Pretorius's power. Apparently, this became even more unwieldy when you hear how it broke down. Hendrik Potgieter led the Soutpansberg, Rustenburg, and Potchefstroom Boers, but Pretorius would also lead the Boers of Rustenburg and Potchefstroom, who didn't want to be led by Potgieter. And W.F. Joubert commanded the Leidenburg Trekkers, and J.A. Enslin commanded those living on the western border of the United Confederation of the Whole Community on this side of the Vaal River. I'm just going to call this the Transvaal, if you don't mind. So, this sorted things out, no? No. Enslin refused to attend the political meetings. Joubert came out swinging in support of Pretorius. The Volksraad was so divided that neither Pretorius nor Potgieter could convene the whole Volksraad. And to be blunt, the whole Transvaal was pretty much in a state of anarchy. Well, not much changes. Anyway, back to our tale. It was their joint enemy, the British, who actually created a situation where the disparate Boer entities felt they could join together. And this was the preamble to the St. River Convention. You heard last episode how the burghers at Wynberg wanted Pretorius to come and take over the land between the Orange and Vaal rivers, and how Pretorius refused. Remember, he was still an outlaw. There was a British price on his head, £2,000. That's about £18,000 today. Major Warden, who was British resident in Bloemfontein, and Hogan Owen all began to realize that the empire could not hold this free state sovereignty. By October of 1851, it became clear that the Trekkers too wanted peace. Talks were held. Eventually, the convention was set for January 16, 1852, at Venter's Farm near the junction of the Koolspruit, the Coal Spruit, and St. Raphael. Here, the Boer delegates gathered as the enigmatic forgerer Van der Kolff fled, with Pretorius and his 300 followers watching. It is with some amazement, then, folks, that this crucial gathering, this fundamental moment in South Africa, lasted just one day. One day! And that one day changed the history of South Africa. A day of discussions were spent with the British commissioners, an instance of the speedy way in which matters can be settled if there is mutual goodwill. On January 17th, the treaty known as the Sand River Convention was signed. The British commissioners, on one hand, and Pretorius, Joubert, and 14 commandants, landdrosts, and field cornets on the other. But no Potgieter, at least yet. The paperwork was dispatched to new governor Sir George Cathcart, who issued a proclamation approving the treaty in May. Then the all-important document was sent by British courier service and by ship to Britain, where Secretary of State Sir John Pakington noted his approval of the convention and Cathcart's proclamation. Back in the Transvaal, Pretorius still did not have control of the territory run by Potgieter, whatever Cathcart et al. And the British Empire believed. The Volksraad was convened in Rustenburg on March 16th, a month after the signing, and finally Potgieter decided he should do the right thing, get on the right side of history, if you like. So he met Pretorius on March 15th, the night before the signing. Strong language was exchanged. We don't have the exact words, but I probably couldn't repeat them anyway. Historians blandly describe this meeting, saying, there was a want of cordiality between the two leaders. And at one stage, it appeared that there would be more than a want of cordiality. There was going to be a split, fisticuffs perhaps. Both men were fiery leaders, tough as teak, but so too were their people, and the folk was sick and tired of this internecine fracas. Influential burghers met both men, pleading with them to get with the picture. All night there were anxious consultations. Elders arrived staggering and waving walking sticks, and at dawn the two men decided to meet in Potgieter's tent. A win for Potgieter's team! Both men actually shed tears in each other's company. For the first time in years, tears of mutual forgiveness, probably respect. Outside, more tears were shed by the folk, men and women. As the sun rose, the flaps of the tent were drawn aside, and there, sitting together, holding hands like brothers, or like young AmaZulu men, as a sign of their brotherhood, an open Bible on the table before Pretorius and Potgieter, the two aging Boer protagonists, were making up. Not quite kissing. A cry went up. The Volksraad ratified the convention and thus entered the lexicon of South African history. The power of the moment cannot be underestimated. By agreeing to recognize the Transvaal Boers, the British had also ironically cemented a form of cohesion amongst the Boers themselves that they did not possess previously. This is why the convention took on an almost religious power amongst the Trekkers from then on, and why, when the British broke their word about this agreement, the Boers went to war. What did this convention signify? That the British relinquished their formal control over the Boers. The British government could not claim any jurisdiction over those emigrant farmers living across the Vaal in the Transvaal. More than that, it was also recognition by the British that the Boers had a right to a newly founded republic, a right to exist. It was regarded by the Transvaal Boers as their Magna Carta, conferring absolute national freedom. The big problem, of course, was no one asked what the black people of the Transvaal thought about all of this. Hogg, Owen, Cathcart, Pretorius, Port Heater, they didn't care. That was how both sides rolled at the time. It is true that nowhere in the Sunt River Convention document does the word independence exist, and it was the lack of this word on a piece of paper that would lead the British to annex the Transvaal in 1877. Had the pen, in later years, not been drawn across the words of the convention, South Africa could have been spared two bloody and unnecessary wars. Big mistake, but that's for later episodes. The Sand River Convention was the high water mark when it came to British Voortrekker relations, and would lead 2 years later to the British abandoning the Orange River sovereignty. The convention contained the following provisions. First, the British government guaranteed and granted the immigrant farmers across the Vaal River the right to govern themselves, according to their own laws, free from any and all British interference, and that the British government wishes, it said, to promote peace, free trade and friendly intercourse with the new country. Secondly, Britain agreed they would have no alliances with coloured nations to the north of the Vaal River. Remember, Major Warden had been providing arms to some of the Griqua, for example. In turn, the Boers promised to stop the practice of slavery north of the Vaal. Both sides agreed that no ammunition and arms should cross the Vaal River border from the south without a British magistrate certificate, and no black people should be allowed to purchase arms and ammunition sold by both Boer and Brit. Criminals would be exchanged between the British and the Transvaal, and summonses for witnesses from both sides of the river would be supported by magistrates on both sides. You know how the devil is always in the detail. All people living in what was called British land should be allowed to sell their land and move over the Vaal River. There were many Boers living in the Orange River sovereignty who wanted to do this. All marriage certificates from both sides of the river would now be honoured. The affairs of love and state, all bound up in a traditional sense, as they are now. One of the loopholes in the convention was the definition of what the Vaal River meant. It rose in the Drakensberg, close to Moshoeshoe's territory. But it all meant that the Boers living in the Transvaal were now masters of their own fate for the first time in the history of South Africa. On May 10, 1852, Pretorius was fated by the English settlers, as well as the Boers who lived in Durban, when he sat down to an enormous banquet at which eloquent tributes were paid to his courage and his statesmanship, his diplomacy. Following which, he rode back to the Transvaal and straight into a major confrontation with Mansour, the Baralong chief, who controlled the Western Transvaal. No one had signed anything with him, and this Sand River Convention meant nothing. It was just a scrap of paper signed by groups of people who didn't have a right to his land. The conflict with the Baralong had been brewing for quite a while, but the tension had risen in the last 12 months. A missionary had warned Pretorius in December 1851 that Boers were encroaching on Mansour's territory. Negotiations proceeded between the Boer commandant Adrian Hendrik Stander and Pieter Skulls, and Mansour and his brothers, and the missionary Reverend Joseph Ludolf, watching it all. Just out of interest, the town of Standerton is named after Adrian Stander. A boundary was agreed upon which gave the Baralong additional springs, one called Mooi Macy's Fontaine, Pretty Woman Spring. This was not the end of the matter, because each succeeding generation of Baralong and Boer required men to move onto their own land. There was only so much veld to chop up, and this was not going to end well. To the south, there was more trouble brewing between Sekwati, the Bapedi chief, and the Boers. Sekwati was close to the Basutu, blood brothers in a way, and like Moshoeshoe, he'd been buying guns and horses. Pretorius complained to the British High Commissioner about English hunters and traders who were indulging in gun running. These men were using what was called the Low Road, or the extreme western bypass into the Vaal. It was the same road that the famous Dr. David Livingstone was going to use and lead directly to a confrontation with the Boers. Pretorius wanted the traders and hunters to head north from the Cape through Potchefstroom and not skirt the west. In Potch, their wagons and guns could be inspected. The Bapedi didn't care about that agreement, and having built up a substantial arsenal, began to skirmish with farmers in the neighbourhood of their kraals. In August 1852, Commandant General Port Heater led a punitive expedition against Sekwati. The trekkers included Commanders Schoeman and Van Wyk, along with six other officers, and 315 burghers. They reached Sequatty's Kraal on the 25th of August in the midst of a winter storm. This delayed the attack. Then Portgieter fell grievously ill and left the commando. Commandant Schoeman took charge and besieged the Bapedi because they were too heavily armed to dislodge. 20 days later, Schoeman gave up and left for home, but it also left carnage behind him. Many of the Bapedi had died of thirst, mostly women and children. And the carcasses of thousands of cattle turned the air putrid. Then unseasonal thunderstorms caused havoc for the Boers. Their horses began to die, and most of the men were suffering from fever brought on by the freezing rain. This was not a successful commando, although the Bapedi also suffered terribly. And no direct conflict was going to break out between these two sides after this for the next 10 years. Another terrible incident was to be recorded in August 1852 on the Western Transvaal border, an incident that would actually reverberate across the world. It involved the famous Dr. David Livingstone I mentioned, the great explorer. He had established himself on the Kolobeng River, not far from Rumutsa today. At times, over the past few months, Livingstone had been allowed to live inside the Transvaal by Portgieter, on condition he did not own any horses, wagons or guns, nor should he gain any sort of military power. The Boers of the Western Transvaal despised Livingstone, who had a good relationship with the local Bapedi and the Bakwena. This all came to a head on Saturday, 28th August 1852, when a commander from the Western Transvaal raided Chief Sekeli of the Bakwena in the village of Dimawi. They had moved there just a year earlier from Kolobeng. During this raid, Dr. David Livingstone's house at Kolobeng, which was 16 kilometres from Dimawi, was broken into and looted. Livingstone blamed the Boers. What happened next is for next episode. Please rate the podcast on your favourite platforms. That helps elevate its visibility. You can head off to desmondlatham.blog, where I'll load an update about this episode. You can email me from there. Also, register for my little newsletter. Until next, goodbye.